For our first teaching of the year with Betty Saltram. And we've got a new kind of format for this year. It's called Ask the Getty. So we don't have a specific text that we're going through. It's going to rely on questions from all of us. So this will be your chance to ask the Getty everything you wanted to know about life, the universe, and everything, and Tibetan Buddhism, and never had a chance to. Today's the chance.
Heringanzu mixe joji ke me bitane tene thotene chein saresra ta enda nim bodre de nga jugle ro ji sare.
So, today's session, we do not have any specific topic to discuss. It's more of a kind of question and answer interactive session. So, I think this is a kind of test for me, examination for me.
Oh, we've got some very hard questions for you, Geshe-la.
It's okay. I need trash paper.
Geshe-la. Dear Geshe-la, during the Lam Rim retreat at Chenrezig Institute in January, I recall that you advised Lama Tsongkhapa said that all the Buddhist teachings were applicable to all sentient beings. I was of the understanding that the Buddha taught different things to different people depending on their personal dispositions, which is why two or more teachings may seem contradictory when compared to each other. If indeed all of the Buddha's teachings are applicable to all sentient beings, does this mean that all sentient beings are essentially the same and just at different levels of spiritual development?
And then need love songs and ne lam sung ka ba long dan chen ne san ji chu de ne sam je tham je ki nyam su len go he ji res che dang ngan zu ta lam rum ka la ya sa je ki che shu di ani song ro ma le tam nga de cha wa se di.
So if you read the Lamrim text, one of the most important outline is that we should be able to perceive all teachings as personal instruction. So the point being made here is that Buddha gave three different public sermons. He turned the Dharma wheel three times, so he gave three public sermons, and all of these three public teachings were really taught in tune with the mental disposition of different disciples. However, we must understand that he taught these three turning of the wheel of Dharma in a progressive kind of fashion, where an individual practitioner needs to implement all these teachings in a progressive manner. First, you engage at the kind of a beginner's level, then you progress and go on to the next level, and then without kind of incorporating, without practicing all of them together, an individual practitioner cannot attain enlightenment. So for an individual practitioner to kind of attain enlightenment, the practitioner must practice all these three higher, the content of all this higher training in a progressive manner. So again here, when we talk about the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, that they are also kind of based on the three higher trainings. So when you practice the content of three wheels of Dharma, you can't practice separate from the practice of three higher trainings. So therefore, the three higher trainings are the very foundation of practicing the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. So, regardless of the mental disposition of an individual practitioner, the three higher trainings, the practice of three higher training is kind of very important. So, whether you are a practitioner at the beginnings level or intermediate level or advanced level, your practice must be grounded on the three higher trainings. And therefore, the three higher training is applicable, or they should be practiced by the practitioner of all different capacities or mental disposition. So, the reason why the practice of three higher training is essential for all practitioner is based on the fact that we all want happiness and we all do not want suffering. And if we want to achieve the happiness that we all seek, and if we want to eradicate the suffering that we do not want, we have to kind of uproot the cause of suffering that we do not desire, and we have to accumulate the causes that lead to happiness. And suffering is primarily triggered by afflictive emotions. And in order to get rid of afflictive emotions, we have to apply kind of remedy or antidote. And the most effective antidote to remove afflictive emotion is the practice of three higher trainings. So therefore, the three higher training is essential for all practitioners, regardless of different background, regardless of mental disposition. So long as you are someone who wants happiness and who do not want suffering, the practice of three higher training becomes important. So in this regard, it's applicable for all practitioners, regardless of their mental disposition. So is it clear? I hope. So this is the question, right? There is a little phrase that comes up quite frequently. Can you briefly explain what is meant by illusions meet? It is mentioned quite frequently in the names of Manjushri. Are the illusions net? Okay,
yeah. That's
one. So I'm not able to kind of recognize the exact words that this term illusions net come from.
You two time to talk in the six seizure today. Any dichagoras, dichagoras,
so generally speaking, illusion is a kind of a metaphor we often use in certain contexts, to particularly in the context of saying that all things lack inherent existence. And in order to indicate that statement, that how things lacking inherent and kind of objective reality, they use the terms such as illusion. And in this regard, just as illusion do not have any essence, similarly, things do not exist inherently. And since there are also certain kind of verses where it says that we are trapped in the kind of illusion of samsaric existence. Now, if we want to get rid of that bondage, what we need to do is we need to cultivate the mind that sees the ultimate reality. So therefore, the mind that frees us from that bondage is the mind that sees all things are like illusion, or all things lack inherent existence. So probably in this context, illusion is used as a metaphor to highlight that things lack inherent existence. So here, when we say that sentient beings are trapped in the iron web of illusion, iron web of inherent existence, so the point is that in order to kind of free ourselves from that bondage, we have to cultivate wisdom. And that is again not, that is also like an illusion. And the person who undergoes this process is also like an illusion. So therefore, in order to kind of really highlight and reiterate the point where all things and events lack inherent existence, the term, the metaphor, illusion is repeated over multiple times. So here, when we use the term illusions net, the net or the bondage that binds us in the cycle existence is also like an illusion. The wisdom which frees us from is also like an illusion. So to highlight the point, the illusions net, the metaphor is used.
Ivan says, thank you, Geshe-la, for being with us today and sharing your wisdom. I have a question about anger. I have a question about anger. I can recognize the energy of anger arising in me, but I don't know what to do to stop it before it becomes a tightening in my chest and a fire in my mind. Can you offer any advice on cooling the flames?
Thì ra nó ngã lại chính cô cái tên cái cái này không được thì là làm gì rồi
So Gisela says, I also need an advice for cooling the flames of anger.
Tadi ti mayu ya ta chada mo so shu chi bi ong yin ba di ta ja ji ya da ma res ro res.
So this is a kind of a very common experience for many of us. And we all have been kind of victims of, you know, anger, attachment, hatred, and so on and so forth. And when they arises in our mind, we all fall victim to their influence, and we can't perform any positive kind of deeds. For instance, when anger and hatred and other negative emotions arises in us, it kind of destroy our happiness. It destroy harmony among others. And then even if you are doing a kind of a recitation or a prayer, and when such negative emotion arises in us, it disturbs the peace of mind and disturbs the kind of, you know, prayer as well. So therefore, we all have experiences of how afflictive emotions could destroy our own peace of mind. So as far as the anger is concerned, for kind of, you know, we all, you know, when anger already arises in us, it might be slightly difficult to pacify immediately, but Shantideva and many other great masters have advised that it is really important for us to think about the shortcomings of anger on a daily basis. And the more we are able to think about the shortcoming and faults of anger and other afflictive emotions, the more we will kind of, you know, engage ourselves, the more we will try to overcome them, the more we try to kind of minimize and reduce them. So the entire practice of Dharma is really to try to pacify, try to see the shortcomings of our afflictive emotions, and then try to reduce them, try to minimize them. And then if we do not try to kind of see the shortcomings of afflictive emotions within our mind, and if we are not doing anything to reduce them, and then whatever other activities that we are doing, it does not become a really Dharma practice. So therefore, it is really crucial to try to contemplate and to reflect about the shortcomings of anger and other afflictive emotions on a daily basis. And then the more we reflect about the shortcomings, the more we will try to distance ourselves from such afflictive emotions. Usually, when anger arises in us, mostly we get angry towards a person or a being, and it's very unlikely that we kind of get angry towards kind of a material things. And it is not the case that we sometimes don't get angry to you know, material things. Sometimes we kind of get angry to objects and tend to break them, and that happens. But most of the cases, we get angry to a person or a being. And then whenever we get angry to a person or a being, it's really crucial to try to think about the positive qualities that they possess. And we may project the other person, the object of our anger, is a very negative person, but it's quite impossible that they do not possess any positive quality. All of them, they do have some positive quality. So therefore, we must try to focus on the positive quality. Quality of others. The more we were able to think about the positive quality of other person, it will help us to pacify and reduce the amount or the kind of the amount of the anger that we have. So in that way, we will gradually be able to reduce the effect of anger.
Dearest Geshe-la, can you please speak about the differences between the refuge and merit field in relation to a daily practice? With specifics,
as to when you use one or the other. Are there any differences between refuge field or merit field? And if there are differences, when do you use one or the other? Thank you, Peter.
아니 라마치비 초신 공단지 코랑코랑에 찍여레스 아니 람람 초신 공단 찍여라스라 에나 람람 초신 공인지 바이나 피기게 아니 주 들려야 아니 템보 템비 원보 내가 기바 망보자 다드스 사마 셀타베 찍 용구여라스라
When we do a merit field kind of when we try to kind of visualize the merit field with regard to different practices, there are kind of, you know, slightly differences in the way in which we visualize different deities. For instance, if you practice the Lamrim merit field, so in that, first you visualize Buddha in the center, and then surrounded by all the direct and indirect lineage masters, and again you visualize the different tutelary deities that support that kind of, you know, tutelary deities, and then you also visualize different bodhisattvas and so on and so forth. So this is how we usually do a Lamrim merit field meditation. And then on the other hand, if you do a kind of Guru Yoga merit field, then you visualize Lama Tsongkhapa in the middle, and then surrounded by all other lineage masters. So therefore, whatever kind of, you know, merit field you are meditating on, there is a kind of slight differences in the kind of details of the field. So usually the Guru Yoga merit field is considered as the most a kind of profound or sacred practice to accumulate merit. And usually we don't do a separate refuge kind of merit field. However, we could kind of visualize a merit field based on the kind of the based on our refuge practice. For instance, we could visualize the master who bestow us the refuge vows, and all the way to the Buddha who initially gave this precept. So in that way, you know, we can practice in different ways. However, the most kind of effective way to accumulate merit is to do so through the Guru Yoga practice. So usually when we do the refuge practice, we often visualize Buddha, Dharma and Sangha in the field, and we kind of immediately start our practice. And then in this way, we sometimes tend to miss the Guru who bestow us the refuge vows. So I think this is something we must all keep in mind, and always try to remember the Guru who bestow us the refuge vows, because through that, by receiving the refuge vow, now we are able to practice the refuge and we are able to enter the path. So therefore, we must never forget and miss the master who bestow us the refuge practice. And then if you somehow miss that, then our refuge practice may not become that much kind of powerful. So in order to make our refuge practice more stronger and powerful, it's really crucial to include the master who bestow us the refuge vows as well. When we talk about the refuge practice and the importance of including our own master, for instance, I have spent most of my time in the monastic institute learning about them, and I have relied upon many you know, teachers. So similarly, all the monks who studied there, they somehow have huge respect towards their own teacher, spiritual master. And sometimes you know, among the monks, when they kind of you know, playfully make remarks and comments about each other's teacher by saying this, your teacher is like that, they often feel very sad, because they have very sincere and pure kind of respect towards their own respective masters. So because of that, their studies and their practice also becomes really profound. And historically speaking, there are many, you know, great masters who have really reached the kind of, you know, pinnacle of practice, such as Milarepa, Drumtemba, and other figures. So all of these really giant, all of these, you know, great practitioners were able to reach that profound state because of their respect and reverence towards their teacher. So therefore, it's really crucial to highlight the importance of remembering and including the one's immediate teacher in the practice. I kind of happen to interact with many people and meet many people, and sometimes people, you know, over the conversation, they say that, well, long time ago, I received the refuge vow from that Geshe, that Lama, and when I ask from whom you received the vows, and then they go, well, I don't quite remember the name of the teacher whom I received the vows. So that is quite unfortunate, because if you can't even remember the name of the guru who bestowed you the refuge vows, then how can you even generate respect towards that individual? So the more respect you have towards your teacher for bestowing you for vows and teachings, and then it starts from, you know, if you don't even remember their names, how can we develop and cultivate more reverence towards such beings? So that indicates that, you know, the point is that if you want to 18 high levels of realization according to Buddhist practice, then it's really crucial to generate reverence towards one's own teacher. With regard to reliance upon a spiritual teacher, I wanted to share an anecdote which happened in the, you know, probably 100 years ago. There was one great teacher called Puchok Champagyaso, who composed the Dudha, or the elementary kind of text to study Buddhist logic. And he often do the meditation on Guru Yoga, or meditation on spiritual masters. And then over time, you know, how much kind of he tried, he was not able to realize that, cultivate any realization with regard to Guru. And then he approached his teacher, said that, I'm trying to kind of practice exactly according to the manual, or exactly according to the teaching, but still I'm not able to cultivate any realization. What could go wrong? You know, what is the reason behind that? So then his teacher asked, are you sure you are kind of, you know, cultivating, are you including all your teachers in the practice? And then he goes, yes. And then later he found that he somehow missed one individual, one teacher, a former nun who taught him the Tibetan alphabet. He somehow forget that, and because of that, he was not able to generate a realization. And then his teacher advised him that, now you should kind of consider that former nun who taught you the Tibetan alphabet as the main kind of spiritual guru, and then you start the practice over again. Then when he did that, he was able to cultivate realization, you know, very quickly. So the point is that kind of reverence towards one's own spiritual mentor is really crucial to cultivate realization.
In the verse where it says, even if I develop only bodhicitta, but I don't practice the three types of morality on bodhicitta enlightenment, I've always not really quite understood why the three types of morality are seen as separate to developing bodhicitta in that verse, because I would assume that those three types of morality were subsumed into the practice of bodhicitta.
Yadan chanchuk sem di sem tsam kye kyan silag data, sem tsam kye kyan, sem kye ba tsam ki digma res, sung yo res, ra.
So I think this question has also little to do with the kind of translation of this particular verse. For instance, in the verse it says, even if I don't develop only bodhicitta, but in Tibetan we have sem tsam. So tsam has the connotation of mare. So here when you use the term only bodhicitta, it somehow says that only by developing, but, you know, tsam has the connotation of simply or merely cultivating bodhicitta is not sufficient. You have to, you know, there are a lot to do more. Simply cultivating the mind is not sufficient, so we should not miss that. So here the point is that after cultivating bodhicitta, of course, first we have to cultivate bodhicitta, and then after cultivating it, it's not, you know, we are not reached the end yet. And after cultivating it, we must kind of continue to practice during the meditation session and post meditation session. So the point is that the practice of three morality is not something that we could practice, you know, during a particular time and then forget not practicing over other times. That's not the case. So is that the question? What are the three types of morality?
Eta nam gyudira ta kasa simjen tenji ge tsurum kasa di chigi ya ti i ti chadon se da da ra.
So here the three types of morality are the morality of individual liberation, and then the morality of bodhisattva, and then the morality of Vajrayana practice.
That was a great question to answer, because I always mix three types of morality with the morality of refraining from non-virtue, the reality of practicing virtue, and the morality of benefiting others. So I didn't realize that reference to three types of morality was for those. Are they relevant to that type of the land room?
So here, of course, you know, it's we must kind of make a distinction between the three types of morality in general and a specific context. When we talk about the practice of morality within the context of six paramitas, then the refraining from non-virtue, practicing virtue, and practicing benefiting others becomes relevant. However, now here we are talking about the three types of morality as mentioned in the beginning of the foundation of all good qualities. He is specifically referring to the three moralities: morality of individual liberation, morality of bodhisattva, and then the morality of Vajrayana.
Yes, well, I've always wanted to know, in the Shakyamuni Buddha meditation, and through the mantras and the purification, and then the Buddha comes and melts into us at the end, how come we don't go and like step into the Buddha? Step into the Buddha's shoes instead of, you know, go the other way around.
This is going to be difficult to translate back in Tibetan. Interesting. So here, usually when we try to, you know, visualize Buddhas, absorbing our body from our crown, instead of that, if we somehow try to get up and step into the Buddha's body, absorb into the Buddha's body, and it somehow become little bit of kind of disrespectful, because our own body is considered as full of impurities. So because of that, it may not be kind of correct. If you are practicing certain Vajrayana teachings, particularly the self-generation of Bhairava, so in that practice, what you usually supposed to do is that first you must kind of, you know, visualize your body absorb into the emptiness, and then from within that emptiness, you visualize your body as kind of, you know, inseparable or same with the form of the deity. You can't directly kind of visualize your body inseparable or same with in the form of the deity, but rather first you must visualize your body being absorbed into the sphere of emptiness, and within that sphere of emptiness then arises the form which you can visualize as the deity. So the point is that we can't simply directly jump into visualizing our own impure body as the deity.
So I'm very new and unfamiliar with Buddhist teachings, and I haven't actually done much reading, but I've been thinking about emptiness wanted to ask, what is the logic of ethics in the context of the realization of emptiness? And that if one refrains from imputations, where then does the value of ethics exist?
To be honest,
this is a wonderful question. So the ethics plays a really crucial role in the context of realizing emptiness. Because when we talk about emptiness, emptiness is nothing but the ultimate reality of all phenomena. And usually when we perceive or when we realize something, we do so through the six doors, the five sensory faculties, five sense doors, and one mental door or mental kind of consciousness. And the emptiness is something that we should realize through the mental consciousness. Emptiness could not be perceived through sensory faculties or sensory consciousness. And in order to realize an object through mental consciousness, it is really crucial to have a very clear mental consciousness. And in order to kind of cleanse or purify the mental consciousness, the morality of, or rather the ethics of speech and body becomes very important, because by practicing the ethics, morality of speech and body, we will restrain our action, and we will somehow help mental consciousness to reach a certain degree of purity. And so therefore, before we try to realize emptiness with our mental consciousness, we must seek the help of morality in order to purify the mental consciousness. And so long as there is impurities in the mental consciousness, we can't perceive the emptiness as it is. So therefore, in order to remove the impurities of the mental consciousness, we must first engage in the ethics. And then once our mental consciousness is purified, then we can perceive emptiness with better kind of clarity.
I have a question about the human body. It's part of our push at rebirth, but it's also impermanent. So, for example, someone might be a Dharma practitioner for a period of their life and then develop dementia, which can't do anything then. What's the best way to look at that? Is it a matter of harm arriving, or how do we get our heads around that sort of changes that can happen in your life?
Shuya ge kokob rani ge shuddi ge yasra manzu chuna da seti rang gi gi nyumu du ngunze chechene.
As I've mentioned earlier, it is really important to remember that whenever we try to practice dharma, and in order to make sure that our practice become a genuine dharma practice, it is really important to see the shortcomings of the afflictive emotions in our mind. And whatever we do, we must try to make sure that it becomes a kind of a contributing factor to reduce the afflictive emotions of our mind. For instance, we do many activities that is seemingly dharma practice. such as recitation, such as making prostrations, and even giving dharma teaching for that matter. So whatever activities that we are doing, if that action does not become ultimately a contributing factor to counteract or to reduce afflictive emotions, then it does not become a dharma practice. So whatever we do, regardless of the activity, it is really crucial to make sure that it becomes a contributing factor to minimize the afflictive emotions. So here, as far as the dementia is concerned, I think there are two different types of memory. One kind of memory that is primarily related with our sensory faculties, the memory that's built or constructed based on the sensory faculties, and the memories that are kind of primarily based on the mental consciousness. And then when we age, sometimes we tend to kind of forget many things, forget memories that are primarily related with the sensory faculties. For instance, my own teacher, when he was around 90s, then slowly he tend to forget things that are primarily based on the based on the sensory faculties, such as the person that he's meeting on the daily basis, or small things that are primarily based on the sense consciousness, and that tends to deteriorate because that memory is highly dependent upon the physical body, and when the physical body deteriorates, the memories which are built on that also tend to deteriorate. However, as far as the memories built on the mental consciousness is concerned, he never kind of forgets. For instance, even if you ask a very complicated philosophical notion or question, he would clearly answer with the same kind of clarity and precision. So therefore, the memory that is based on mental consciousness never deteriorates if you are kind of a practitioner. So similarly, when we age, we sometimes tend to forget memories, like gross levels of memories, such as the names or names of places, person names, so on and so forth. That is because the memories related with the names of a place or person that are primarily related with our sense consciousness. And sense consciousness is yet again highly dependent upon our physical body. And then when the physical body, the substratum physical body, when that deteriorates, the memories which are dependent upon that kind of basis or that body also deteriorates. However, the memories that are built on the mental consciousness are not directly dependent upon the sense or the body. So therefore, they don't kind of forget memories which are built on the basis of mental consciousness. For instance, if you ask them questions about emptiness, if you ask them questions about renunciation, and other kind of complicated philosophical questions, they will answer with same kind of clarity and precision, which indicates that their memories built on the gross levels of memory may kind of tend to forget, but the subtle memories will still reside.
In the section of concentration, is the main object of concentration the Buddha or are there other objects?
Chidang yu kare shaja yin sar yis. Ra chidang ki ting yin sin ju kong bay na. Nam ju su su ki sem la ya. Ani chal le la u chik yor ra ta
So here, when we talk about the object of concentration in a kind of a general context, we can choose whatever kind of object that is easy for us to imagine and easy for us to visualize. You can choose that particular object. There is no specific kind of restrictions that only Buddha should be the focal object of concentration. However, if you consider yourself as practicing Buddhist, and if you have already taken the refuge vows of Buddhism, then it might be kind of better to put Buddha as the main primary object of concentration, because there are many advantages for doing that. If you are a Buddhist practitioner, then of course the as part of the refuge practice, recollection of the Buddha is very important. And the more we are able to remember and recollect the qualities of Buddha, the more it will kind of help us to practice virtue, the more it will help us to motivate and inspire us to engage in constructive deeds. And not only that, after going for refuge to Buddha, it will also help us to restrain or rather refrain from engaging in destructive actions. So when we could do that, ultimately it will also contribute to develop a strong concentration as well.
The lamrum din roje chi situ ba na ani din ma mi ba kar kar yu me di sew shu yor asra pe sew yor ta.
And with regard to that, I highly recommend all of you to read The Middling Stages of the Path to Enlightenment by Lama Tsongkhapa, where in the middling stages of the path to enlightenment, he clearly explained different types of kind of focal object for concentration and for different practitioner with different mental dispositions, what kind of focal object should be kind of adopted and so on and so forth. So there is a very kind of clear description about that. If you could go through that, it will also benefit you. For instance, so depending upon the different mental dispositions of the practitioner, for instance, if you are someone who is very kind of angry in general, then you might choose to kind of focus on compassion as one's focal object. And then on the contrary, if you are someone who is strong kind of attachment and so on and so forth, then you maybe choose to focus on the unattractive nature of the body and so on and so forth. So there are many different kind of objects in tune with the different mental dispositions. So if you could, you know, practice by reading the Lama Tsongkhapa's middling stages of the middling stages, middle lamrim, then it will become very productive.
I have a question about Tonglen practice, and I've heard two different techniques of Tonglen practice. One technique I have heard of is where you take on the sufferings of all sentient beings or the person suffering, and you visualize it as black smoke or black energy going to your heart center as a black pearl, and then visualize giving white light or as a white pearl or giving white energy to the others, to all sentient beings or to the other person. The other technique that I've heard of and I've read about is visualizing the black negative energy and suffering of all sentient beings or the other person, visualizing it entering one channel through your right channel as black energy, and then giving out through the other channel as white energy, white light, giving all good qualities to all sentient beings or the other person. Which one is correct?
So I think both techniques, you know, seems to be fine, okay, because as far as the Tonglen practice is concerned, different lamas, different teachers have different kind of experiences and different ways of teaching. And so long as a particular technique is kind of relevant for you, so long as a particular technique works better for you, then you can definitely go for that particular technique. And depending upon the mental disposition, depending upon your way of thinking, you know, certain techniques may not resonate with you. So whichever technique resonates with you better, you can definitely go with that technique. So I think it's crucial to see what technique resonates with you better. I wanted to share an anecdote that happened to the Chinese Institute a long time ago, where during one weekend course, they had a course on the Tonglen. And during that time, the teacher taught about certain visualization technique where you visualize a deity, a nectar descends from the crown, from the deity, and absorb on you. And then you take all the kind of sufferings of the sentient beings to you and kind of turn them into a form of a blood or something, kind of impurity, and then release them and so on and so forth. However, one participant from the course felt very uncomfortable by this technique, and she was very upset with this particular technique and left the session. So the point is that certain techniques may not resonate with you well, and it's then with regard to that, it's really crucial to see what techniques kind of resonates with you better. So as far as I'm concerned, I've spent most of my time studying the writings of Lama Tsongkhapa, and I have huge reverence to the Lama Tsongkhapa's writings and his practice. So similarly, the point is that if you kind of read his writings, you will find that all of them have very kind of reliable sources, are based on reliable sources, and not only that, they withstand logical reasoning. So therefore, it's really crucial to base your practice on such a reliable teaching. And if your teaching, if your practice is based on a reliable teaching, that is a reliable source based on an unmistaken experience of a highly realized master, then there is no doubt that you will be able to kind of achieve same level of realization. Otherwise, in this day and age, we will find many teachers who sometimes taught without kind of depending upon a reliable source, then I'm not very sure how kind of, you know, beneficial that will be. So therefore, it's really crucial to make sure that our practice is based on a reliable teaching and reliable source.
I have recently experienced burnout due to stress. I find it difficult to balance working on reducing self-cherishing and self-grasping while promoting loving kindness and so forth. And my own self-care. I know part of this will include self-compassion, but what do you think might be helpful to prevent burnout? And I've added an extra note, this is from us translating, just to say that burnout is a state of complete mental, physical, and emotional exhaustion.
Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the term, the middle way philosophy. Or the Madhyamika philosophy. So the term Madhyamika or the middle way means an approach that is free from two extremes. And that approach is not only applicable to the philosophical kind of standpoints, that concept is also applicable to our daily activities as well. So therefore, whatever we are doing, it's crucial to make sure they are free from the two extremes.
Sejik mandanya, chageng mandanya, samlu mandandi, and it is same chonder kirma toshu di gandroyadi, pekal kaburasra.
The concept of middle way is also applicable to our kind of work-life balance as well. For instance, if we have no work at all, of course, that's in one extreme. We need work. And then if we work excessively, that's also another extreme. So therefore, it's really crucial to try to find a balance between these two extremes and try to find a middle approach. Otherwise, there are techniques which will allow us to deal with such mental disturbances. However, you know, for ordinary beings, we may not be able to dedicate that much time to undergo all the mind training techniques. So the point is that of course, if there is no job at all, that no job is in one extreme, and then excessive job, doing so much work, is an another extreme. Sometimes we tend to kind of have a very high kind of ambition, and in order to achieve that, we tend to work excessively. So therefore, it's really crucial to find a kind of a middle approach or middle way or a balance between these two extremes. So all of us, regardless of who we are, we tend to encounter challenges in our life, whether you are young, whether you are kind of geshe, whether you are monk, whether you are layperson, whoever you are, We are bound to encounter certain difficulties and challenges in our life. And when we encounter such challenges, if we feel completely overwhelmed by the situation, then this will make us totally kind of, you know, discouraged to face the situation. So therefore, it's really crucial to have courage and not feel overwhelmed whenever we encounter challenges. And in order to, in the face of such challenges and difficult situation, if we could think that, if we could accept the situation by thinking this, this could happen and this too shall pass, or these are kind of temporary. If we have such mental attitude towards the situation, towards the difficult situation, so it will make the situation lighter and it will somehow give us courage to face the situation and then make us more kind of stronger to deal with the situation. So I think this is a potential or right a means to face such situation. And I do not have any additional things to add on this.
I had a question about holidays. Many of us have come back from holidays, and some had good holidays, and some worked in their holidays, and some had terrible holidays. So what's the Buddhist definition of good holiday? And what makes a holiday beneficial experience? And is there a purpose for holidays in Buddhism?
I think we can't afford to go on holiday until we are totally enlightened. So I think the whole purpose of holiday is to give us kind of peace of mind. And then as a Buddhist practitioner, the more we try to engage in the practice, the more we kind of enhance and advance our practice, the more we will be able to enjoy and experience peace of mind. And that is kind of somehow same to a good holiday. And for instance, in my own case, on a daily basis, I do spend certain time on the daily recitation and other practices. And then I really do enjoy doing this. And for me, there are no better holidays than doing this, because this is what I enjoy doing it.
Thank you, Keshava. Just a question, just to clarify the persona of root guru, because often in many practices and in some prayers, it mentions or visualizes root guru. So I was just wondering, is the root guru for us the Buddha? Is it Lama Tsongkhapa? Is it His Holiness the Dalai Lama? Is it the Lama Tsongkhapa Rinpoche? Is it the teacher who took our refuge vows? Just to clarify who the persona of Root Guru actually is. Thank you.
So usually when we talk about Root Guru is of course not limited to one single individual or one single teacher, but whomsoever we feel connected or we could consider that person as our own Root Guru. For instance, in my own case, I have received immense teaching from many teachers, and my immediate teacher I feel very deeply kind of connected to, because he's the one who taught me about Buddhist philosophy. Because when I first reached here, I'm just a ordinary nomadic child who doesn't know anything, and then he taught me from the very basics of Buddhism to the most advanced levels. Although I did not receive any kind of Vajrayana transmission, initiation and vows from my immediate teacher, but for me there is no difference between my own immediate teacher and His Holiness or Buddha. So therefore, whomever we feel connected to, we could consider that person as the root guru. For instance, Gijita Tsering has been teaching in the Chenrisig and Laritambha Center for more than 18 or 19 years. And then I have met people who have received teachings from Geshe-la for more than 18 years and still says that Geshe-la is not my root guru. So I felt kind of, disappointed or rather sad to hear that. If you don't consider your teacher who you've been receiving teaching for more than 18 years, if you don't consider that person as your root guru, then there is definitely something wrong with our understanding of the guru devotion.
When we're reading the sutra, I'm not sure who it was that said, but the Lama Tsongkhapa came up with a method or a way to determine what sutra is definitive or what's definitive. I guess I'm wondering if it was a method that he came up with, or did he outline all of the sutras and said, okay, these ones are interpreted, these ones are definitive.
Sibu tajibu tendi yo ma dine ya pe neng to so ani pe ne chik chik she wa na tam ding ni de long di sa war che is so na che chik de ro o dindi jin de lam sun ka besa du se ja chibu ma res thomas se ja dindi ma res
the way to determine if a sutra is definitive or the interpretive is not kind of first taught by Lama Tsongkhapa, but rather Buddha himself has taught this in the sutras. There is one sutra called Samti Nirmochana Sutra or Sutra Unraveling the Intent. So in that sutra, if you read the sutra, Buddha clearly make a distinction between the sutras of definitive and interpretive nature. And then later, if you look at writings of Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, both of these great scholars have also commented and wrote extensively about the interpretive and definitive teachings. So basically, in order to analyze if a sutra is interpretive or definitive, we really need to use kind of logical reasoning. For instance, if we take a meaning of a sutra literal or definitive, then if that faces certain logical fallacies or if that could not withstand the logical kind of standpoint, then such sutras are not to be taken literally. So basically the point is that if you read Chandrakirti's entering into the middle way, or if you read Lama Tsongkhapa's essence of the eloquence, they are technical, of course, but you will see what kind of method they use to determine if a sutra is definitive or interpretive. So, for instance, even in the sutra, there is a discussion where during the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, Buddha said that all things do have inherent existence. And during the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, he said all things do not have any inherent existence, which is, directly contradictory with each other. And during the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, some of his students asked the question that, well, Buddha, you have taught differently. First, during the first sermon, you said all things do have inherent existence. And during the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, you said things do not have any intrinsic existence. And you can't speak contradictory statement. So what is the whole point of teaching two seemingly contradictory statement? So this, he said that, remarked that, in order to, he made such statement based on three kind of criteria: the basis of his statement, the purpose of his statement, and the direct kind of logical contradiction to the statement. So based on these three, you can determine if a sutra is definitive or interpretive.
A question from a student here: if you're finding it really hard to forgive someone who's hurt you, what can you do?
So I think, it is really important to make sure that we place importance on our practice. For instance, if you are a practitioner, then we have to abide by the three kind of vows that we have discussed earlier. And if you consider yourself as the practitioner of Mahayana, then of course you have to receive the vows of Bodhicitta. And then the more you cherish these vows, the more you cherish these practices, then it will also help you to cope with certain such difficult situation. If you kind of practice these vows without any defect, then whoever kind of try to hurt you, then it will somehow become easier for us to forgive such people and deal with such situation if our practice is really solid and strong. So many of us have been practicing Buddha Dhamma for a long time, so we all are familiar with the practices. Some of us has been receiving vows and and being practicing for a very long period of time. And now the thing is, we must try to understand, or we must rather cherish the preciousness of the vows that we keep, the practices that we do, because although the complete state of enlightenment is very precious, but it's a bit difficult for us to reach that state, or we are rather yet to attain that state. So what is really readily available to us, and what is is our own practice of these moralities. So by understanding the precious nature of this, and if we could somehow practice without any failure, then by understanding the preciousness, then we could achieve many other things, and our own practice of patience will also be enhanced if we cherish the three moralities and so on and so forth.
Thank you.